Meditation.
Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean,
days
I just feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Thanks again for listening to the podcast. Today on the podcast, David Perrin. He's a regular contributor to the podcast. As you know, this was a talk that he gave at our weekly Dharma gathering about a month ago. Actually, it was Thanksgiving week. And it's about speech, the thing that I'm doing, I think, right now. But about freedom of speech. And what is real freedom of speech? Sometimes our habits can feel like a trap. You know, getting into it on Facebook with X, Y, and Z about fill in the blank. You know what I'm talking about. Or seeing our family members over the holiday break and the patterns of communication that, well, they don't feel like freedom, do they? They feel like something else. So what is real freedom of speech? Well, this is the topic of today's talk. And speaking of speech, and speaking of the podcast, and speaking of David Perrin, I know, you can't get enough of the podcast. I'm the same way. This is why I'm very excited to announce, are you listening? Are you paying attention? The Meditation in the City podcast is going to become a retreat, a week-long retreat. And it's going to be called Meditation in the City Retreat. See how that works? And it's going to be led by David Perrin, the very guy that you're about to hear, the very guy that you have heard on many episodes of the podcast. So what does that mean? What is this retreat business? Well, it's maybe you've attended a weekton in the past. That's what this is. It's a weekton. It's a week of meditation. There'll be guided sittings. There'll be Dharma talks. There'll be a chance to relate to each other as a community. And it's happening in New York City. Yes, a retreat, a meditation retreat in New York City. You don't have to go to the mountains. You don't have to go to the woods. All you have to do is get on the one train and go to the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org. You'll see a link on the homepage, Meditation in the City Retreat, Winter Weekton. You can sign up for the whole week. But if you can't do the whole week, you can sign up for the first weekend, or you can sign up by the day. There is a discounted early bird rate now, only now until the new year. So if you sign up between now and December 31st, you can take advantage of that early bird rate. Again, go to ny.shambhala.org for more information and to register. And now, here's David Perrin.
The title of this talk is Freedom of Speech. So how many folks here have seen or heard about this book? Okay, a few of us, right? So this book is called The Lost Art of Good Conversation. It just came out this fall. It was written by Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. And what I'm going to talk about tonight, obviously conversation, speech, that realm of things, and hopefully this is somewhat timely for this time of year as well, in terms of how many people are going to see family this week. Yeah. So maybe this week, maybe some point in December, speech and conversation becomes a little bit of a loaded topic. And tonight, I want to offer what to me is somewhat of some provocative ideas, actually, around freedom of speech. Because if I say freedom of speech, what immediately pops into your mind? First Amendment, the press, Trump, president,
Twitter,
yeah. Yeah, all of this stuff. You know, I was thinking earlier when I was thinking of a quote, I don't know if it's even a quote, but there's this notion that when we sit down on the cushion to meditate, our whole society sits down with us. And what that means is that we don't meditate in a vacuum. We're all part, every single person in this room, if we went around to each person, we'd find out what folks do for a living, whether people are in school, what neighborhood you live in, those family, how you feel about those family members you're going to see this week or not see. We're all part of different systems, different social circles. And so when we sit down, I don't know about you, but was anyone having a conversation with someone tonight on the cushion, a silent conversation? Imagine if we could hear everyone's conversations that were going on, the little thought bubbles. The room is quiet and it's actually full of conversations. So we don't meditate in a vacuum. That's the first notion. So how do we find freedom through speech? How do we find freedom through speech? I'm going to talk in a few moments about First Amendment and from that context, because again, we happen to be meditating in the United States of America, so that's very pertinent. And with social media and the current administration and the current political climate, obviously, you know, free speech is a thing. It's always been a thing. It's a thing now, just like it was 200-300 years ago. So what is freedom to you? What, just like you were yelling out before, different ideas, what does, when I say freedom, just let's take out not even freedom of speech, but freedom, what does that word connote for you?
Safety.
Safety, good. Choice. Okay. Come on.
Democracy.
Great.
Ability.
Ability. Expanding limits. Good.
Misnomer.
Lee, we might have to give the disclaimer. Lee is a student of mine, so we meet regularly and we talk about whether free will is a thing or not. So that might come up tonight. You might find Lee throwing little jabs my way. Okay, so yes, these are all good words, all very much in the ballpark. If you look at actually, it's amazing, the dictionary definition gives so many examples of free, like more than other words, and maybe, I don't know why that is, maybe because it's really hard to wrap our mind around what it actually means, but the gist of the kind of the core of it is this idea of being clear of obstacles or obstructions. So clear of obstacles or obstructions, unimpeded. So this idea of being able to move out, to have choices, there's an openness, we're unconstrained. So that's the definition. What does freedom feel like? Like imagine stepping outside after you've been cooped up inside for a long time. Or imagine getting out of a relationship that felt really claustrophobic. What's the feeling of freedom?
Relief.
What's that?
Relief.
Relief, yeah.
Fresh.
Lightness, potentness, did someone say? Openness, great. Clarity. Good. Liberty. Yeah, so a lot of these words that we use to approximate what it actually feels like, in this particular context tonight, what I want to offer to you is that that is our home ground. That's the home base. So that when we experience, we feel that liberty, that freshness, that walking out into something, we're actually coming home to something that has always been there. and may have been impeded or obstructed, or someone may have tried to take it away from us, but it was never something that we had to go out and get. It was from birth. It is innate. It is a natural. It is naturalness. It's naturally who we are. That feeling of connecting to that. And so let me take it a step further. Another definition of free is this idea of, you know, it's for free. Can't be bought or sold. Right? So there's this notion that it's not something that someone can give to you. It might be something that they can try to take away or impede, but it's naturally occurring, so they really are just getting in the way of it, you know, or smothering it. The word, so I'm going to speak a little bit about etymology tonight because I love delving into words, and the Sakyong does this a lot in his teaching and his writing. The word actually, you're familiar with Sanskrit? Sanskrit's one of the oldest languages on the planet and very much the source of a lot of Buddhist teachings and Hindu teachings, Vedic teachings. It's actually priya is it's free is related to this word priya, which means if anyone knows this, I'll be super. You get free. I'll give you a free weekend at the Shambhala. Priya means friend, and there's actually an old English word freo, which similarly means friend. So freedom. Equated with this notion of friendship, meaning that we are, for one, that it can't be bought or sold, that true friendship can't be bought or sold, but also means that we're together, there's a quality of kinship or being together with, there's a wholeness there, right? Like when we're with our best friend, we feel that actually it's bringing forward or bringing out even more of ourselves. And maybe that's some people's experience of meditation. Would anyone describe meditation in that way? It's bringing out more of who we are. So now let's talk a little bit about freedom of speech, because when we start to get into the expressive nature of things, particularly in when you talk about the Dharma or the Buddhist teachings, when you talk about the expressive nature of the world, things get really interesting because things can move in lots of different ways. You start talking about energy and color and movement and dynamics and relationships. So freedom of expression. So what does the First Amendment say? It's the easy question, and I'll give you the hard question. I mean, you said it earlier, right? It gives us, it ensures what? Freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And when that's ever up for debate, what happens then? Like if someone, who decides, basically, in our system? The courts. So you can go through a laundry list of cases where a violation of freedom of expression was claimed, and then the court decided whether it actually was or it wasn't. And it often has to do with like this determination of whether there was imminent danger or imminent harm based on what was being expressed. So here's the hard question. Well, it was obviously an amendment. So are there any history buffs in the room? Anybody? One time I was giving a talk on astrophysics, and do you remember that night? He was sitting right over there. And I started talking about how stars were formed, and I had an astrophysicist in the crowd, so he just started giving the talk. It was an amazing moment. So, who's the history buff here tonight? No one? Come on, who's secretly in love with Hamilton? Even if you haven't seen it, you've listened to it 100 times. So who was one of Hamilton's, if you were to name his main people that he was fighting against, and why? And what's the story at this point in American history? You guys are so shy. Jefferson, right. So Jefferson was one of the people. So everyone, if I would go home and I would be like, okay, what? I'm gonna remember what happened. So there was a government was being created. A nation was in reaction to and after the war. A government was being created, right? And so there was a group of people like Hamilton who believed there should be a strong central government, right? And there were the anti-federalists, included Jefferson and Sam Adams and a number of other people. And those folks, what was their fear?
Tyranny.
They feared that if we created a strong central government, what was going to happen? We were going to recreate England, and we were going to be a monarchy. So they proposed these amendments. It was actually a whole laundry list of amendments, and only 10 of them eventually were, in the Bill of Rights. But they created those out of suspicion, out of some sense of being fearful that there was going to be, that their autonomy, their sovereignty was going to be taken away from them. So where I'm going to start to go with this, in this kind of Dharma context, is that expression can come out of multiple motivations. And there's this notion that when it comes from a place of doubt or suspicion or fear, that actually we begin to create a situation where there's an us and a them, and there's two possibilities that what can happen at this point, right? Because freedom of expression is important. Does everyone agree with that? So critical intelligence is important. And actually, that gentleman there, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, talked about critical intelligence. It was never described, meditation was never described as a point where you just sit on the cushion and try to turn off your mind. Or you just become this, you become kind of this blob, of this peaceful blob, where nothing bothers you and you don't ever intervene. That's not the notion of meditation, even though sometimes subtly we have that idea that, okay, I'm just going to get peaceful, and whatever thoughts I have, I'm going to put them to the side, and then when I get up, I'm going to just be completely accommodating to people all the time. Well, that's not meditation. So there's critical intelligence involved. There's this very interesting word that I want to share with you that comes out of Tibetan. So the teachings of Buddhism were originally written in Pali or Sanskrit, but as one of the migrations was to Tibet. And the Tibetan language actually arose as a confluence with Buddhism. And so there's a word in Tibetan, the word is tetsum. And it's sometimes translated as doubt, but it is very interesting because the notion of, it has two kind of parts to it. The te of tetsum means not belonging, feeling left out. So feeling excluded, not belonging. And the tsum refers to being hesitant or timid. So what happens with all of us in many situations is that we feel in a certain situation like we don't really belong. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but I'm going to share a story in a moment where it's very much happened to me. And then we have a kind of vacillation. We're not quite sure how to respond. When we don't feel like we belong, we wonder, well, should I get the hell out of here? Should I fight back? Should I fight for my rights? Should I establish my sovereignty or my autonomy? So this was the case for me and my father. When I was in my late teens, I started hanging around. So this was in the late 80s, early 90s. I started hanging out with a lot of the early, the political activists who were getting very galvanized around anti-globalization. So you remember Ralph Nader, Jeremy Rifkin, Vandana Shiva, David Corton. These were all people who were thinkers who were advocating against like a global hegemonic corporate dominization. And I actually did this study abroad program in college where it was like a comparative global ecology program. We went around and we literally, a lot of it was witnessing some of the environmental degradations that had happened. And what we were being taught about was at the hands of this kind of corporate greed, you know, the IMF, these unfair trade laws, all of this stuff to where, you know, as a young person, I really feel like, oh my God, the planet is for sale. And marginalized people are being taken advantage of all over the place. And what am I a part of? And I came back to the States, and who was sitting across the dinner table from me but my father, who worked, who was a high-level corporate executive. And so we used to have these wicked arguments. You know, everything from Cargill and the big agro companies to McDonald's, Coca-Cola. I was very Puritan, and I was scared, you know. But there was another aspect of it too. It was about my relationship with him was about this idea of whether I was being seen or not. You know, it was about being in the space right before the argument, wondering whether this was a man who acknowledged my existence. And because I had that titsum, because I had that doubt of whether I belonged to something, and certainly in the bigger picture, a world that I could feel good about, that I felt like, in my opinion, he was helping to protect, not to exploit. I mean, that was really the terms that I was seeing it in. And so in that vacillating space, where my mind went to was anger and resentment. So doubt became this confused emotions. And the critical intelligence part of what I still, beliefs that I still carry about wanting to protect the planet and have a fair and just situation for all people, that critical intelligence was to some degree sabotaged by the emotionality of how he and I were relating to each other. And a lot of times I walked away from our arguments, we couldn't keep talking to each other. And I walked away so angry and so resentful and so hurt that I'd lost my ability really to clearly see, and nothing productive had come out of what we were doing together. So I was arguing for freedom, but I was creating my own confines. So one of the interesting things that happens is that in this moment there for me, directly challenging authority, I begin to doubt my own authority. So this is what I want to begin to highlight in this idea of freedom of expression, that when we are fighting for what we believe and we are expressing ourselves freely, there's an inner process that happens that if we're not kind of aware of the motivation and where that's coming from, that gets expressed through our speech in a way that is actually disconnecting us from our critical intelligence. It's disconnecting us from our own power and our own authority, which is really about what sitting on this cushion to me is all about, is connecting us to our own innate confidence, and you could say authority in that to that degree. So the Sakyong says that what we're doing through speech is we're trying to reconnect with, he calls it the sun of goodness. So this dignity, this basic worthiness, we're trying to reconnect with the sun of goodness in our hearts using speech to awaken naturally good qualities in ourselves and others. Using speech to awaken naturally good qualities. So obviously speech links our body and minds. Speech is this bridge from what's going on in our own heads, what we were talking about before, all those thought bubbles, to actually being a vibratory presence in the world that's related to this quality of atmosphere. And as we're seeing demonstrated every day, speech can be used for good, and speech can be used for hurt and creating harm, right? And so that there's this notion that the breath, even before we put sound to it, the breath is already a vibration, right? So as we're sitting on the cushion, even if we're not lost in thought and listening to the voices in our head, we're listening to our breath. We're listening to the vibration of our breath. And so there is actually a kind of, in that paying attention quality, this is people talk about mindfulness becoming present, but what are we actually tuning into? What is this vibration that has an expression of this mind that is neutral? It can be directed in any given way. And yet, tuning into speech, as the Sakyong says, is this moment where we're going to begin to define our own freedom. And so he gives in the book a lot of different examples of how this paying attention, just even on the level of personal practice, Thich Nhat Hanh, how many people are familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh? Yeah, so a very famous Buddhist teacher. He has the five mindfulness trainings based on the precepts that often people in monastic situations will take on. And the fourth one is around speech. So why do people take these precepts? Why are people paying attention very closely to speech and to slander and gossip and telling falsehoods? I've been going through this with all of my kids, but my eldest son, last night I asked him to do his math homework. This morning he wanted to watch something before he went to school on the computer, and I said, "Did you do your math homework?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Can I see it?" So he goes downstairs, and he's down there for like 10 minutes. I'm thinking, and then, you know, Ann and I, my partner, we're looking at each other like, why? We didn't say that it was, you know, we're not promoting lying, you know, but he's figuring that out for himself, and we can't do it for him. We can kind of give him a sense of what the repercussions are if you do that, but he's only going to find out for himself, right? And so that's what this fourth mindfulness training is. It's cause and effect. It's if we do this, how are we going to feel? If we slander and gossip, how do we create the own conditions, our own conditions for our own kind of imprisonment? So it's very interesting in this book. You know, the Sakyong says that the problem, particularly if we're in a disagreement with someone, right? So if we're about to have an argument or about to get to that point of an argument, the problem is actually not the when we launch into, when the emotion starts to set sail. The problem is right before that. It's that space of that vacillation, that hesitancy where we don't know what's going to happen. And this is often the reason why people, many people will never come in and do what you did tonight. They'll never sit down on a cushion. Because it's too scary to be with ourselves in this kind of free and open moment where we don't know what's going to happen next. And that is very heightened in our encounter with other people. So we practice this alone on the cushion so that when we get into that moment with another person, we can, you know, we often here at the center, we do these, have you ever come to a Tuesday where the speaker says, okay, now turn to the person next to you, and you go, oh my God. No. And that's because that person's not even mad at you. Imagine if that was a boiling point and that just right in that moment before the encounter, you were about to kind of like, there was that quivering quality of what's going to happen next. And so actually, rather than, in terms of speech, rather than being free to express, freedom of expression, we can say whatever we want, the Sakyong says, actually, take a moment. Don't say anything. Slow down your speech. Contemplate the idea of getting in a heated argument with someone or some sort of heated situation. And contemplate the idea that in that moment, you're repeating the same argument over and over and over and over again. Because again, it's coming from that basic uneasiness that we have just before we respond, just before something happens. That open space is a very uneasy place to be. So we're training on the cushion to feel the moment and to feel if the moment needs a little bit of humor and levity, if it needs some space. If we can actually let that person say something that we wildly disagree with, but give ourselves a beat so that we're not going to respond as quickly as we might normally do. So I want to close with a quote from the book. And hopefully there's this, to some degree, I maybe conveyed this notion that freedom is not quite what we think it is. And actually, we're very much creating the conditions for our own freedom all the time. Because there is a direct correlation between personal ethics and our vitality. There's a direct correlation between personal ethics, how we choose to speak and use our speech, how we choose then to act. Speech often leads to actions. So the connection between that and our vitality, so how we feel about ourselves, whether we feel at home, whether we feel our own worthiness and dignity. When we practice this art of conversation, he calls it the art of conversation, the art of mindful conversation, we create an energetic flow that accomplishes our intentions gloriously. Accomplishes our intentions gloriously. So we may be standing up for what we believe in. We may be expressing ourselves so that we're not being oppressed or hindered by another person. But that's coming out of this quality of personal ethics that's related to our vitality. And then we accomplish, and at the same time, and this is an amazing line, because in Shambhala it so much comes back to what happens with all of society. Contributing to the ability of the entire society to breathe. So with our speech, creating the conditions for our own freedom and for the freedom of others, even those with whom we vehemently disagree. So that the whole of society can breathe. So my question to you is freedom of speech all about being able to say whatever we want to say? Which is another way of saying, do you think everything I said was bullshit? Do you have some questions about it?
So thanks for your speech. But I was hoping you could talk more about the relationship between freedom of speech and emotions,
mm-hmm.
especially when someone else thinks they have the freedom to say whatever they want to you, and oftentimes breach your boundaries and that type, you know, how you manage that kind of phenomenon.
Yeah, so hopefully what I was trying to convey tonight a bit was that when emotional doubt, so often emotions start as thoughts, so emotion starts as one thought, and it usually is in that space of me being separate from you, right? So what arises is there's a friendship. The innate basic way that things work is that you and I are friends. We're not separate. That's the way of the world according to the Dharma, to the teachings. But in the moment where I create a division for whatever reason between you and I, like, oh, you're more handsome than I am, or you have a better job than I do, or you're saying something that is putting me down or where I come from down, whatever, or even more subtle than that, then my thought begins to snowball into having a particular emotion of anger, jealousy, coveting what you have, being drawn, you know, wanting to seduce and sort of take you in. So in that case, when my emotional speech is coming from my own insecurities, my own tetsum, my own feeling ostracized from the world and not a part of something, but actually on the outside of it, so that I'm in that fluttering zone of like, oh my God, I don't know what's going to happen next, then yes, behavior emanates out of, it started as a thought about separation, it grew to an emotion, and then it results in behavior. And at that point, I may transgress your boundaries. I may perpetrate on you because I'm so far away from understanding my own insecurity that it just seems like you are the cause of it. You did it. So in that moment, and we talk about this as being a tradition of warriorship, that's where the warrior, the meditator, has to rouse, basically what the Sakyong is saying in this book, has to rouse the ability to figure out how your boundaries can shapeshift. So either putting up a strong wall, or actually sometimes it's thought of as being like a bunch of balloons. That what that person is trying to punch you, you don't. You're constantly dodging it. You don't get hit in the face. And determining whether or not there is some form of speech that will be able to engage someone, it depends on how far down the line they are emotionally. But typically, if your motivation is to create the conditions for your own freedom and others' freedom, then that intention will go a long way in towards that person settling down and realizing that they might actually be able to have a conversation with you. And that might be in that moment, or it might be... So what happened with Reese, my son, this morning is when I told him he couldn't watch... This is the... You all get the rest of the story. I told him he couldn't watch the video, and he got very angry. And he said... And he admitted to lying, I said, you couldn't watch the video. And I said, thank you for admitting, because now we can be together. And when you lie to me, you just cuts us in half. and there's no way for us to communicate. But when you tell the truth, even if you did something wrong, then we couldn't be in relationship together. So he got very angry, and he put his hood over his head, and he didn't talk to me for the whole commute to school. And then we got right, he's even though he's 11 years old, he's still a hand holder. He likes to hold my hand. So we got close to the school, and he reached for my hand. So the space and time and me wanting us to both be in a space of freedom allowed him to settle a little bit and kind of his priorities shifted. So it couldn't happen that quickly. It might take a much longer time than that. But your practice is going to give you a kind of perspective that that person doesn't have. So there's a care involved. There's a responsibility. Just by being a practitioner, already we are responsible for the care of other people. Does that help? Yeah.
Yeah, man. David Perrin, how about it? Thank you for listening to the podcast, as always. Again, David Perrin will be leading a week-long meditation retreat. It's our Meditation in the City retreat. It's happening in February. For more information and to register, go to nynachambala.org. Click the link on the homepage and check out all our other great options, courses, weekend retreats, and community events. If you happen to live in a different city, not New York City, that's okay. There is probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Shambhala is in a lot of different cities across the globe. But of course, if you are in the New York City area, you can come to our weekly Dharma gathering and hear these talks live and in person every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Later.